Thank you, Tony, very much. Good. Well, it's a little bit of a challenge for me to jump in here because there's such a varying degrees of sophistication in the audience. So I'm just gonna do my best to try to take you through what we know about this disease. I'll say just one word here, which is sort of stated in here somewhere, that when you're actually in the Alzheimer's field right now, we all feel a little bit stuck, that the Alzheimer's field has, you know, we don't have a treatment. When you take other major disease categories, there's been inroads in cancer, there's been inroads in arthritis, there's been inroads in diabetes, and certainly in infectious disease. In many of areas of medicine, there's been major progress. But in this category of diseases we call neurodegenerative, of which Alzheimer's is the one that's the most famous, the very few FDA-approved treatments are like Band-Aids, and we just don't have any deep understanding of this disease the way we have of cancer, for example. So we're gonna do this, what's called here, a rapid romp through the field. I'm gonna show you a plot here. This is the kind of thing you learn to do in medical school, is to draw plots without units. And So you can see here that as a person's cognitive function, if it declines very rapidly, we call it dementia. But almost everyone, as they get older, has some cognitive decline that is on the green line. And it's just extraordinarily common. It happens to 99 or 98% of people. And it is probably we might say it's as normal as wrinkling of the skin. But or maybe not, because there is a blue line where there is a handful of people, about 1% of people, there are famous people like this, like Pablo Picasso, who continued well into their 90s with extraordinary creativity. We don't understand the difference between cognitive aging and successful aging, and that 1% difference, and we certainly don't also understand the underlying biology and physiology of this red line either. So there's a lot to learn here. But let's start at the beginning. And in this very amazing time during the early 1900s, when Albert Einstein published his papers, James Joyce began the first sketch of his book, which became Ulysses. At the same time, described Alzheimer's disease. He didn't name it Alzheimer's disease. It was actually named by the boss of his institution where he worked, named Emil Kraepelin, who was a psychiatrist, and was looking to bring more grandeur to the institution, and said, you know, hey, Alois, let's call your disease Alzheimer's disease, and wrote about it in a book, a very famous textbook that Kraepelin published. His first case was this woman, Auguste Deiter, who died in 1906 at age 55. And the big contribution that Alzheimer made was to correlate her clinical picture, that is the fact that she was developing dementia, with what was going on in her brain. So let me show you what that contribution was. Here's two brains, an Alzheimer brain, a normal brain. Actually, that's not completely normal. That's a dead person. The key point here is that the Alzheimer brain is shrunken. You can see that because the brain is full of the sulci and gyri, and these sulci have widened because the gyri have shrunken. So you see an atrophic brain here. It weighs less. It's typical of Alzheimer's, but it's not diagnostic because the boundary line between the shrinkage of the brain that occurs in everybody as we age and crossing over to Alzheimer's is a very indistinct boundary. You can't really use brain, volumetric studies of brain to make a diagnosis. But that's what it looks like grossly. But how you do make the diagnosis is under the microscope. And this is what Alzheimer saw, these two structures. One are called senile plaques, which are these things right here. They are this gunky stuff, which I'll tell you about in a moment, which sort of oozes out from certain cells in the brain and starts to penetrate into the interstices of the brain, And it's basically extracellular, blocking up all the connectivity in the brain, senile plaques. The other hallmark structure are these neurofibrillary tangles. The distinction is a different protein. It's made up of a protein called tau. And those tangles, they collect inside the neurons. And when they're in there, they begin to form these. This tau is a normal protein, but it begins to polymerize and become highly insoluble and form these big rope-like structures, these multimeric polymeric structures in cells until it absolutely strangles them and they die. And sometimes these tangles actually remain after the cell around them dies, and we call that ghost tangles. Now, the one of the interesting problems, which another thing we still don't really understand, is that why are certain areas of the brain hit with this pathology and certain other areas spared? So because the protein like tau and amyloid, they're present in all cells, but yet there is a topography for Alzheimer's disease which is very characteristic. It tends to hit the hippocampus, the amygdala, the hippocampus being a memory entry point to the brain, the amygdala being an emotional part of the brain, and then it spreads through the cortex a little less densely. But it spares certain areas. It spares the cerebellum. It spares some midbrain structures in the spinal cord. So why this distribution still remains curious. So all of that has been known for a long time. And then if we come up a little closer to the present, but still pretty far back, we actually arrive to these guys, Blessed, Tomlinson, and Roth. We're now in the year 1968. We started in 1906, and they published a really seminal thing, because in all those years before 1968, you probably heard these words, things like presenile dementia. Because Alzheimer's patient was only 55 years old, people thought this was a condition of younger people, and that when older people got dementia, it wasn't really anything to worry about. It was just getting old. It was senility. It was just a disease that we would tend to dismiss, hardening of the arteries. There were all these sort of politically incorrect words that were used at the time. We now understand, since this publication, that the condition that older people get is identical to the one that Alzheimer described in a younger person, and that Alzheimer's disease can afflict younger people, but the vast majority of people, the greatest risk for the disease, of course, is aging. The incidence goes up exponentially as you get into your 70s and 80s. So to the point that by the time a person reaches age 85, the risk for this disease is around 40-45%. So that takes us to 1968. Now let's get into late 70s and the 80s, when another guy named George Glenner was trying to figure out what that gunky stuff, those plaques, that amyloid in the brain, what it actually was. And he noticed that the same very similar appearing material, at least just by light microscopy, that the very, very similar appearing material was also lining the blood vessels on the surface of the brain, called the meninges. And you know, here it is here, this is a very old-fashioned type of light microscopic stain, nothing fancy. And he saw this material. That vessel shouldn't look like this. There should be more cellularity. They're just very smooth, and the reason they're so smooth is because he hypothesized that the same material that was in the plaques was also in the walls of these vessels. And a lot of people doubted him, but he went ahead, and the reason this was such a clever thing to do was because he could almost purify the material in a simple dissection. You can just, if you have a brain sitting out in a bucket, you can just peel off the meninges by hand, and you get a very highly enriched preparation of the vessels. And then his next finding was is that this stuff is very insoluble in agents that will solubilize many other proteins. So we put it into a solution of guanidine thiocyanate and just spun it down. Really, I mean, the most simple purification you can imagine. And he has this pellet. And now he put that pellet into an amino acid sequencer, a protein sequencer, which using a process called Edman degradation takes off one amino acid at a time. And he then published the first, I forget, 20 or so amino acids from this material. And he published it in an obscure journal to a big yawn. Nobody was that interested. They said, this stuff is not that important. And even if it is important, you know, it's just not going to be necessarily the key finding in this disease. But gradually, things began to change. Interest began to surge in Alzheimer's. We're now getting into the late 80s and the early 90s. And people went back to this publication that came out only 5 or 6 years earlier and said, wow, there must be something there. That stuff really does look important. And they, you know, this is long before the genome. You know, now if you're interested in a gene, just look it up in a database. Then the only thing we knew about this gene was about 20 amino acids, which was not in any database. So as the interest surged in this field, there became actually a highly competitive race to be the first to clone this gene. And it got quite intense. We're now into the late 80s, early 90s, and there were, like often happens in science, there were three groups that got the answer at about the same time. But the one that was probably first was maybe by a few minutes was this guy, Dmitry Goldgaber, who was at the time at the NIH working in the laboratory of Carlton Gattacek, who, as you know, was one of the discoverers of Kuru and prion disease in New Guinea. And Dmitry, he was a postdoc at the time, and he slaved over all the possible codons that could possibly encode this sequence that had been published by Glenner. And he finally got it. And now in the early 90s, he showed up at a neuroscience meeting with this sequence, having cloned the gene. But he had not submitted an abstract. He had not done any preparation for this meeting. He had just gotten the sequence a couple of days before. Came into, you know, I remember this so clearly. He walked into the session. He asked the chair if he could present his new data that he had cloned the amyloid gene. And chair said, no, you know, you don't have an abstract into the meeting. But he finally agreed to let him do it. And he said, you can present, but you have to present at the very end of the session. And so he's standing outside. He's really, he hasn't slept for about 2 weeks, and he's very disheveled, and he's got like northern blots falling out of his portfolio. And he finally gets up there, and he just, he gives extremely good evidence that he now had cloned this gene. This is now like 5:30 in the afternoon, usually when the sessions are nearly empty. Instead, the room was filling up because word got around that someone had cloned this gene. And and indeed, there was quite a, the room was really impressed because it was clear he got it. And he then pointed out another thing too, that which sort of made sense, which is that the gene is actually located on chromosome 21, which is where, when that's triplicated, people get Down syndrome. And this trisomy 21 is also associated with getting lots of amyloid in the brain. So it looked like the disease was really cracked, that by having this now this level, that the overexpression of the amyloid gene might have something to do with this disease. And another thing became apparent with the cloning of the gene. We learned another very important thing, which is that the only piece that Glenner had sequenced was that peptide that was actually in the amyloid itself. But of course, the parent gene turned out to be much larger. So the parent gene actually looks like this. It's the amyloid, we call it the amyloid precursor protein, and it is present in all cells, not just brain cells. It has a small region which sticks inside the cell, It goes through the membrane one time and has a large ectodomain outside the cell. And this is the piece that Glenner cloned. This is the piece that ends up in the plaque. So we have a situation like this, where this piece gets cut, and now all those pieces assemble into the plaque. So this now opened up a number of questions. So here's the picture again. Here is that full-length amyloid gene. Here's the membrane. And as it became clear that there had to be a cut right where that red arrow is, and that really presented a big problem, because people at the time could not figure out how a protease could get into this highly hydrophobic environment of a lipid bilayer where you need at least one molecule of water and cut something. So it was just, it was a very curious thing. There were also some other cut sites, and since no one knew what these enzymes were, they just got to be called secretases. So the gamma secretase was that red arrow. There's another cut that can, that looks like it's a good cut. It could happen. This is the piece that Glenner cloned, that Glenner sequenced, but there's another enzyme that cuts right in the middle of it, so it would prevent the formation of those bad peptides. And then there's another cut called alpha secretase over here at the amino end of this peptide. So there's these putative, still unknown enzymes that had to exist, that once we cloned the gene, not me, we, the field, cloned the gene in APP. So of APP. So the so there was more stuff to find. And not one more point that came out of this a little bit later was is that if you, this is the beta amyloid, those peptides that aggregate, and if you count the number of amino acids here, there are 42. But there could actually, this could actually form in several ways. This cut right here, this intramembranous cut, could cut after that alanine to give you 42, but it can also cut after this valine to give you just 40 amino acids. And whether it does the valine cut at 40 or 42 has a lot to do with how toxic that beta amyloid is. But what the alanine here, it is considerably more toxic. We'll come back to that in a moment. So when you look at this amyloid stuff under a scanning electron microscope, it just looks very gunky. It's not very ordered. And it's thought that one of the problems with it is that these that the gunky stuff is bad enough, but when it's more in some oligomeric form, it may actually interfere with synaptic connections, and before it just totally aggregates into large plaques. So I'm going to say one more word about the amyloid here, and that's to bring you up to the present, which is one of the things, because we're going to come back to this in a moment. I'm going to talk about those enzymes. But I want to say one more word about where we are right now with regard to amyloid, which is in the last 2 years, it became possible to use certain ligands and visualize amyloid in a living person. So that now, instead of waiting for the person to die so that you can look under their brain under the microscope, we can now, if we're suspicious of amyloid in the brain, we can add a radioactive ligand that will bind, and the brain will light up. The insight that came with this ligand was that these letters up here, this stands for Alzheimer's disease. But before people get Alzheimer's disease, they start to get a condition called mild cognitive impairment, MCI. And it turns out the insight with these ligands was that when people have MCI, that is just, you know, it's just what it says, minimal cognitive impairment. You don't have very much impairment at all. Sometimes it's even undetectable. But already at that point, the brain has a lot of amyloid in it. So we now know that amyloid deposits in the brain big time, even before there are very many, if any, symptoms of Alzheimer's disease. Just like atherosclerosis, you can have, you know, a vessel full of fatty lipids, you don't really know it until you have a heart attack. Okay, so while this people were working hard of homogenizing brain tissue and doing biochemistry and trying to figure out more and more about this amyloid and study what these enzymes were, there's another whole group of scientists that approach the problem in a totally different way. And this is a little bit of work that we did, but we weren't the only group.
that is to find, to take, to, instead of going into a lab, go out to the field and find big families that have Alzheimer's disease that's inherited generation after generation. We knew they exist. Some of them were pretty big. And they get Alzheimer's at age 45, usually 50, 40. They get Alzheimer's at middle age, quite young. And when you look at their family trees, there's just no question that this is an autosomal dominant condition. Generation after generation, it's being inherited. And so the family we studied actually turns out to be the largest family in the world with this familial form of Alzheimer's. They live in Colombia, in a remote area of Colombia that is called Antioquia. The capital is Medellin, but they live out here in the countryside. And there's, in this family, there's about 5,000 people that turn out to have a mutation, which I'll tell you about, that leads to early onset, a dominant mutation. And they, but of course, when I say 5,000 people, this is, we're talking about fifth, sixth cousins. They don't even know that they're related to each other, but they are because they all have this same rare mutation, which I'm going to tell you about in a moment. So the first person to clone the gene responsible for this condition actually came from a different family. The first person to get it was a guy named Peter Hyslop, who cloned this gene in a family from southern Italy, another large family, not quite as large. And then this family and other families followed right on the heels of it. So several several genetic studies, these are called genome association studies, where you can just track genes, track the people that have the that have the condition, the phenotype, with their with different markers in their genome, and you get an association, and it gets to, after you do a lot of it, it becomes statistical, and then you believe, it. So the gene, this is the gene that was found in all these families. Different mutations in a gene. It was called presenilin-1, and because it was causing this kind of senility at a younger age, and this looks like a really different beast. It really goes passes through the membrane multiple times. This would be the lumen. This is the cytosol. So so this could be like, you might think of this as the outside of the cell, but it's actually often in the endoplasmic reticulum, so it's in the lumen within, you know, within the contents of the cell, and it's got many different mutations. I didn't really mark them, any of them here, but it's turned out over the years that we now know maybe 100 families or more around the world that have different what are called private mutations. It's only in that family. The Colombians have one mutation. Here it's up here somewhere, right? I think it's right there, and. But families have different mutations spread all through here. So what happened is that this was now discovered in a totally different way. This was discovered through genetics, not biochemistry. But then one day, this guy named Michael Wolff, who actually worked in the lab right next to mine when I was in Boston, he was just relaxing after dinner one night, staring at these sequences, kind of thing we like to do sometimes. And he noticed that here in this transmembrane domain, there was an aspartic acid. He said, well, that's a little strange. Why would a charged amino acid be sitting in a membrane? You know, it can happen, but it's just a little bit unusual. But then when his eye gazed over to the next one, he saw another one. He said, wow, two in a row. And he knew, he was a very good biochemist, Michael Wolff. He said, this is exactly the feature of a kind of a protease called an aspartyl protease. So here he is. He said, maybe somehow these two membrane domains, these aspartyl proteases have two aspartic acids right next to each other that are involved in the cleavage of some substrate. And maybe they come together somehow, and the presenilin actually works as an aspartyl protease to cleave at the gamma secretase site, the APP. And it turns out that he was nearly right, because it's not exactly this. It's actually, this is part of a bigger complex. But he was pretty close to the right answer. And this turned out to be a part of a complex that does that very unusual intramembranous cleavage that I showed you earlier on. And And I think this is really remarkable because it shows the convergence of one group of people who are using one type of technique in a lab, biochemistry, and another group of people doing field work. And together, one group finds the enzyme and the other finds the substrate. It's just a remarkable biology story. Here's how it would just be looked at. These barrels are alpha helices, are the presenilin with the APP sitting right in here, and this two aspartates causing the cleavage. That's how we think it works. And actually now, this is just a model, but there's some pretty good, still relatively, well, they're getting to be higher and higher resolution crystal structures that are actually finding that this is pretty close to what is reality. Okay, now let me just jump back now to that other hallmark of the disease. Remember we talked about these senile plaques, but the other side of the coin were those neurofibrillary tangles, the ones made up of tau that are inside the neurons. What about them? Well, here they are again. They're here. Here's a ghost tangle. The cells died, but that's still the tau protein still sits there. It's very highly insoluble stuff. It's even more insoluble than amyloid. Doesn't solubilize in any detergents. And not only is it inside these cells, but it actually, you know, neurons have these complex, just these beautiful dendritic trees that have this architecture spread out in, with tertiary, quaternary branches going way out into the cortex. And they become finer and finer. And they too fill up right here in this kind of what's called neuritic pathology of this tau protein. It also sits there. And this is the kind of pathology that's also now become typical of what's gotten a lot of attention lately, an entity called CTE, or chronic traumatic encephalopathy. This is what the football players are getting, years after they've had multiple concussions. This is what their brain looks like. They are accumulating lots of tau. They don't have amyloid, but they get lots of tau. This is probably what Muhammad Ali has in his brain as well. So if you look at these under an electron microscope now, they are much more ordered than the amyloid, at least at this level. So they've been called paired helical filaments. They have this periodicity to them of about 80 nanometers. They're about 20 nanometers thick, and you can see them. You can actually purify and look at them. You can put in antibody to the tau protein down at the EM level and look at the gold particles actually lining up on the filaments. They're clearly made up of polymeric tau. Now tau is also tau's a normal protein. It's bound to microtubules, which are these railroad tracks running all through the cells, carrying cargo around all over the place in all cells. Here's the nucleus. Here's all these microtubules spreading out. And here's one of them in high power. And it's made up of all these subunits in which various motors, kinesin, will bind and move cargo along. And one of the proteins that binds to the microtubules is tau. It's thought that it will stabilize the microtubules. It promotes their polymerization. But it's clearly doing more complex things than just that. But that's about what we know right now. And the other thing that's interesting about tau is that it's microtubules are everywhere, and there are lots of proteins that will bind to the microtubules to stabilize them in all cells, but in the brain, but tau is a brain-specific microtubule stabilizing protein. It just that's what it does to microtubules only in the brain. So here you see a neuron with the tau staining out here in this long branched axon. So tau too was cloned, and it is like, you know, many genes. It has this intron-exon structure, the exons being the coding regions. It has these repeat regions here at the C terminus, which are binding to the microtubules. And it turns out that tau also is full of mutations. Here they are. I mean, there's mutations in this exon, these are all different mutations showing you what a missense mutations that are changing, say a glycine here to an arginine at this position. These different, every single one is being indicated. Interestingly, there are not only mutations in the coding region in tau, but there are also mutations
at this splice junction. There's no amino acid that changes at all. The abnormal protein has the same sequence as the normal protein. But this is this exon is quite interesting because sometimes this exon is in the final protein and sometimes it's out. We call that alternative splicing. So these mutations control how much of this exon is in and how much is out. And when you have a mutation, you alter the ratio of the two, what are called isoforms, by just a little bit. And that small imbalance in the amount of tau then triggers a disease. Let me tell you what that disease is. This is a little bit of an overbearing slide. This is another thing that medical students have to do, memorize all this stuff. These are all the different diseases associated, and there are more, associated with tau mutations, but not Alzheimer's disease. So the these look a little strange, but you can see here's that CTE that I mentioned. Here's another form of dementia. They're all neurodegenerative diseases. In every case, tau is accumulating, it's making tangles, it's killing neurons, and it's doing it. The main difference between these really is just doing it in different parts of the brain that creates different clinical phenotypes. And that's what we're seeing here. So you have all these diseases, you know, for a long time, after from probably the time almost of Alzheimer himself, when people saw the plaques and they saw the tangles, the field was extremely contentious. There were, like, in one corner of the room were the people that believed in tau, and the other corner were the people that believed in amyloid, and they would fight to say which is more important. And it almost became like a religious battle in which the beta amyloid people were called Baptists, and the tau people were called Taoists. And the cloning of tau and the identification of these mutations gave the Taoists their own diseases. And now there was a little bit more peace in the field. But tau was always sort of the poor sister here, because the evidence for amyloid being the primary driver of the disease is really extremely strong. But there's been some more insights lately that have forced us to really think very seriously about tau. And this brings us up very close to the present now, where you can see that there's beginning to be evidence that some of these misfolded proteins are spreading from cell to cell like prions. As you know, prions are misfolded proteins that can get out of one cell in a misfolded manner and into a neighboring cell. And when it gets into the neighboring cell, the misfolding of that protein will then template the misfolding of the normal protein in the neighboring cell. That's really what a prion is. So in the cases of prions themselves, discovered by Stan Prusner, that's what happens. But that concept may now be the case for many other diseases, including tau, and there's a long list of neurodegenerative diseases, Parkinson's disease with another protein called synuclein, and Huntington's disease with Huntington, and these lists go on and on. Lou Gehrig's disease, or ALS, with another entity called superoxide dismutase. There's a lot of different proteins that will misfold and may be behaving like prions in almost all of these neurodegenerative diseases. Maybe we're getting close to some very fundamental concept that will explain a lot of these conditions. So the last couple, maybe the last 5 or 10 minutes, I'm just going to take now a little bit of a forward look and allude to some questions going forward, and even touch upon for a moment some of our research directions. So one question here is that when proteins misfold in cells all the time, it's very common. It's thought that a very high percentage of proteins after translation, after the messenger RNA is making in the ribosomes or putting together one amino acid at a time, even these nascent proteins
can, at earliest stages, undergo misfolding quite frequently. And there's lots of really good mechanisms in the cell to get rid of misfolded proteins. And there's a whole unit called the proteasome, which is the trash can that takes all these proteins, and the whole recognition system with a protein called ubiquitin that binds to proteins that are misfolded and moves them into the trash can. It's a system that's really well worked out. And somehow, tau evades that system. We don't understand why that is. Why is that system not really operating? Because the tau protein does seem to be targeted for the proteasome. It often will get ubiquitinated, but it just somehow is not getting degraded. So I think understanding this kind of problem of what's called proteostasis is an important facet of what we have to learn. What are the biophysical properties of tau that predispose it to misfolding and spread? And here we have an awful lot to learn. It really fine timescales, high resolution pictures of tau that's undergoing these kinds of assemblies at the very earliest stages of nucleation and understanding the true biophysics of this misfolding. So that's one direction. Another direction here is, why I'm just posing this sort of rhetorical question at the top, why don't we have a treatment? Well, one thing is we lack a lot of good models for Alzheimer's. There are animal models. You can put these genes into mice, and they make plaques, and they make tangles. So it's not that we completely lack models, but they're just not replicating the disease sufficiently well to be to allow us to make inferences that will be therapeutic. So now there's this technique that we're doing in our lab, many other people are too, that are called mini brains or organoids, in which you can actually take a skin biopsy from anyone, including a person that may have one of these mutations, and then convert those skin cells into what are called induced pluripotent stem cells, that is, return them to their pluripotent state by just putting in some transcription factors and now making them into stem cells. And then once they're stem cells, you can then differentiate them into neurons. These are, very good neurons. They're human neurons. And if you do it in a certain way by taking the cells and putting it into a hydrogel, what's called matrigel, so it has some structure around it, you can actually get them to form three-dimensional organoids or mini brains that actually have some of the topological, some of the 3D features of brain itself, with the lamina that you see here, the layering, and particular antibodies that seem to label each of these layers. So now we have these things, they can just be a few millimeters in a dish that can be used perhaps as a model for the disease and for looking at treatments. So that's one approach that looks promising. Another approach that that we also are very interested in here, I've been working with Paul Hansman and Gene Carlson on this, is trying to see if we can understand better the interface. If neurons are nothing else, they're electrical. They have synapses. So can we try to better understand the relationship between all these genes and the biochemistry I've talked about and the electrical activity that's going on? That just seems to be a missing piece that's not clear in the field. It's not been adequately addressed. So so in our group, Paul has his neural circuit probe that we can put neurons down on these multi-electrode arrays in culture. We can put human neurons down on this. It's a flat array that has 120 electrodes underneath it. And then we can track all the spiking or the action potentials and begin to assemble the connectivity networks involved and begin to look at Alzheimer models that way. So that's a little bit of a taste of the future. I try to give you a little background here about the way the field has moved and just touch upon a few of the future directions just very, very briefly. But there always are people in the audience, and for a very good reason, that are really interested about what they can do to try to prevent this problem. And so I'll just give you one little, right now there's no pills for this, there's no drug you can take, there's nothing that, no vaccines, no penicillin.
So the only things that we have are these things that are statistically associated with lower incidence, these lifestyle things, like the old things you know, exercise and stress reduction and good diet, keeping your blood pressure controlled, keeping your lipids controlled and your glucose. These are all factors that are known to increase your risk for the disease. They're all modifiable factors, and they're all things that, you know, since the risk is so high by the time we get to age 85, it's crazy not to be able, not to be trying to do this stuff. Okay, thank you all.
Thank you, Ken. So he's promised to take questions, and I'm sure the audience will.
Questions? Yes.
Please.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes.
Why are these neuropathies contagious, or are they? So the way prions are, if they're moving between cells and templating this.
Yeah. So that's a great question. There was a very worrisome paper that was just published in Nature like just a week or two ago that suggests that they may be contagious. There was lots of caveats. It was not something to worry about, but basically this first sort of slight shadow of contagiousness surfaced because there were about 30 or 35,000 kids that got back in the, from I don't know when to about 1985, that got growth hormone that was ground up from human brain because they had growth hormone deficiencies. And because it was ground up from human brain, no one knew this at the time, but some of them came down with prion disease. They got what's called Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, this, you know, this very rapid form of dementia. But your question is why, you know, how come, what about these other conditions? So what this paper actually showed was is that when several of them, when about eight of them died of Creutzfeldt-Jakob, and they looked at their brain, and they were relatively young, they were in their 30s or 40s, they had a fair amount of amyloid in their brain, which would not be expected at that age. They didn't have tangles, you couldn't call it Alzheimer's, but there was some, that was the first little shadow that something might be going on. On the other hand, it would be totally alarmist to say that these things are contagious in the same way that Creutzfeldt-Jakob is, because you have to, there must be many other factors that determine how contagious something is. That is, that these are misfolded proteins, so how many of them are in some sort of folding trough, and what's the on-off time, and all these different factors. There, you know, misfolded proteins that come in many different species. Some are in prions, some are more contagious than others. So if there is any likelihood that these are contagious, it's there's been enough exposure to brain tissue with all of these conditions that they probably have very low, what's the word, contagiosity?
Yeah. Down syndrome,
he's
had a lot of amyloid plaques.
Yes.
Is there any excess Alzheimer's among that?
There sure is. So Down syndrome, you know, these kids are impaired from birth, but then when they get into, if they survive long enough, they often have heart defects and other problems, so very often they die young, but if they live into their 40s or 50s, they almost invariably have Alzheimer pathology in their brain, plaques and tangles, and also usually show some impairment in their ability to perform in their workshops or whatever they're doing.
You mentioned misfolding.
Yes.
Are there classes of misfolding?
Yeah, this is that is undoubtedly true. This, you know, whether these misfolded proteins are oriented in the same direction or opposite directions, there's some beautiful work on this. The most recent paper to come out was from David Eisenberg at UCLA that had some just gorgeous high-resolution structures of the way they misfold. And we also know that, as to more directly answer your question, that that the very same proteins misfold in multiple different ways. So, and that's been clearly shown with prions.
So, Ken, I know that you did a few work in Colombia. autoimmune. So the natural question is whether Alzheimer's is a gender difference, a racial difference, or a regional difference?
Sporadic Alzheimer's, the form that does not carry, is not associated with any mutation to which we're all vulnerable, has really, there's no, you know, ethnic, racial, it affects everyone equally. There's some economic disparity because if you can't do all this stuff, you're more likely to get it. So if you come from a poor area, you do have a little higher incidence. But there's really no, the work in Colombia is different because these are mutations, so that they occur in discrete areas around the world of people that were unfortunate enough to be in a family like that.
At the educational level, in the popular press, there are often stories of you use your brain more.
Yeah, that's true. There's this whole brain reserve hypothesis, which is the leading idea that there's clear statistical data that if you're educated, highly educated, you're less likely to come down with Alzheimer's disease. But the problem is that what's really happening is that if you're highly educated, you're getting your likelihood of getting plaques and tangles is exactly the same as everyone else. You just have enough reserve in your brain to fake it, and to pass those neuropsych tests and to get by. So we don't, the Alzheimer's doesn't become apparent. That's the leading idea. So one of them is called Aricept, and there's a couple Me Too drugs in that same category. And what they do is somebody a while ago noticed that of the various neurons that die, the neurotransmitter for some of them is acetylcholine, cholinergic. So the idea was, well, hey, you know, in Parkinson's disease, in Parkinson's disease affects the substantia nigra, which is dopamine, and all the pretty good treatments for Parkinson's disease, symptomatic treatments, replace it with this drug called Sinemet. So they said, oh, how about Alzheimer's? Let's replace those cells with a certain neurotransmitter with this drug. And so they gave acetylcholine. They said, that's the one that should be replaced. Or they gave it a drug that inhibits the enzyme that makes it. That breaks it down, and so that's the drug. And it's the concept. It just doesn't work very well. That's literally a Band-Aid.
Other questions? Could you say a little bit about the fate of the drugs that try to dissolve plaques?
The fate of there's no drug out there now in clinical use that can dissolve plaques. The ones that cause worse problems and that they tried and still trying are antibodies to remove plaques. So the leading idea right now in the therapeutic realm is to put in antibodies that will be delivered peripherally, either subcutaneously or in the vein, and then travel across the blood-brain barrier. And a small amount of them do, about less than 1%, but it may be enough. And once you get these very highly specific antibodies into the brain, they can then clean up the plaques. So there's pretty good evidence that works in animals. You do get the plaques cleaned up. And then it actually looks like it also cleans up the plaques in people, because the people that got the antibody when they died, their plaques were really much, much reduced. But they still had dementia. So this is... This was fuel to the anti-amyloid people. We don't quite understand exactly. So people still have a lot of hope that these antibodies may work. There's a clinical trial going on right now in Colombia and elsewhere to look at better and better antibodies. But we have to have a certain skepticism about that.
You mentioned dementia a couple of times. Is there a clear-cut technical difference between Alzheimer's and dementia?
Alzheimer's is a type of dementia. It's one of many types.
It's a subset
of dementias. Yeah. So everybody's looking for that. the answer is probably yes. So there is, I mentioned these really rare genes that that more than increase your risk. These are highly penetrant, autosomal dominant. There's one more gene I should tell you about that increases the risk in all of us. It's present in, well, not all of us, but in about 25% of us. It's called APOE, and it comes in different alleles, and one of them is called APOE4. And if you're among the 25% that has it, your risk for Alzheimer's goes up a little bit. And there's a lot of debate about whether people want to be tested or not for that. So there is a risk gene. There's another flavor of APOE4 called APOE2, which is pretty rare, but may confer some protection. So there's a really interesting study that's going on right now by a guy named Steve Friend, who is, you know, you know that no matter how bad the mutation is in mice or flies or wherever you put mutations is, you can always find some other mutation that rescues it. This is the whole basis of how people do genetics. The rescue mutations is how we learn about stuff. So what Steve Friend is doing is saying there must be people out there that have some of these really serious mutations, which we know in these families are highly penetrant. You don't escape them. But maybe somebody else in some other family has the same mutation but doesn't have any disease. Maybe they have the rescue mutation. So one, I think, really interesting search is to look for these. They're hard to find because they're healthy people. But to find those people that have the rescue mutations for these would be really fascinating. Just as likely to develop the plaques and tangles, not necessarily the symptoms.
Right. But my question is there any evidence that doing mental exercises also prevents, stimulates the synapses?
Yeah, there is a little bit of evidence that it does. It builds into the same concept of the brain reserve thing that if doing mental exercises or learning a language or playing an instrument does provide some mental reserve. There's some statistical support for that. Highly educated in these studies means bachelor's degree.
To what degree is this recognition understood? And are there other examples of where that goes wrong and people get over?
Well, it probably goes wrong in maybe most of these neurodegenerative diseases, because almost all the different proteins in neurodegeneration, the synuclein in Parkinson's, and I can go through a whole list, get ubiquitinated but don't get degraded. So it's a pretty fundamental problem. And it's really interesting to think, why they don't get degraded. It's also interesting to think what the ubiquitin is seeing that makes it decide. Because, see, these proteolytic pathways in cells that are targeting proteins for degradation are really sitting in a very important decision node, because closely related to the proteolytic side is another whole fascinating category of proteins called chaperones, which will help a protein now fold back correctly. So when a protein is misfolded, there's another decision that has to occur. You have to say, okay, it's over for you. You're going in the trash can. Or I still have some hope, and a chaperone come along and get it back. How that decision is made, I don't think is well understood.